The views expressed on the Making It Matter podcast are that of Gunnar Esiason, Julia Ray, and guests, and not necessarily those of the Boomer Esiason Foundation. Nothing in the Making It Matter podcast should be considered medical advice. Such advice can only be given by a physician who is experienced with cystic fibrosis. The Boomer Esiason Foundation, Gunnar Esiason, Julia Ray, and guests cannot be held responsible for any damage which may result from using the information on this podcast without the permission of your medical doctor. You're listening to the Making It Matter podcast with Gunnar Esiason and Julia Ray, presented by the Boomer Esiason Foundation and GunnarEsiason.com.
Hey there, it's Gunnar Esiason. Thanks for joining Julia and I for episode 19 of the Making It Matter podcast series, The Psychological Impact of Hospital Stays.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Making It Matter, a weekly podcast presented by the Boomer Esiason Foundation and GunnarEsiason.com, highlighting the challenges that people with CF face and the people who face them.
Since Julie and I both have cystic fibrosis, we're remaining compliant with the National Cystic Fibrosis Guidelines regarding patient interaction and cross-infection by recording via Skype. This podcast was made possible by Novartis, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, and the Digital Credit Union. So big thanks to them for always supporting Boomer Esiason Foundation educational programs. So this week, we actually received a tweet version of a question. The tweet came from @Ruth_Hochberg, and she asked, or rather she stated, "I'd be interested to learn about coping and psychosocial effects of long-term hospital stays on people with cystic fibrosis, as well as if there is a contrast between 6 days and maintenance stays," which is a great question. So thanks, Ruth, for the question. We'll throw this over to Julia because she has far more experience in this department than I do.
Yes, thank you.
Something to be very proud of.
I am. Gold star for me. I can so vividly, I love this question because there are so many memories attached to hospitalizations for me, like turning points in my life. And I can vividly remember the first hospitalization that I can recall is when I was 6 years old. And I was in first grade. And my classmates would come to visit me. And the biggest thing was that they all made get well cards for me. And that was when I really realized that CF was something that they were not facing. And because I had an older brother with CF, I kind of always thought like, oh, everyone goes home and does therapy. And this was kind of a wake up call that, oh, shoot, this is not normal. Whatever that means, but that was a big turning point for me, I guess, psychologically in my development as a young child. So do you even remember when you realized that?
Yeah, I think looking back, the first time I was hospitalized was when I was two, that's when I was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. And obviously I don't remember that. As the story goes, I was very sick. I was actually intubated. You know, I don't have any recollection of any of that. I'm sure that was horrible for my parents.
Right.
Not so horrible for me because I don't remember it. And I obviously lived to tell the story. But when I recognized, I think, that I had CF and there was something different about me was when I was also in first grade. That's the first time I ever needed a PICC line, at least in my memory, that I needed a PICC line or IV antibiotics. And I actually ran away from the operating room where they were going to place the PICC line. Because I was just so terrified of the whole thing. So that was really when I recognized that I had CF. It wasn't really a deterrent for me to take care of myself. I think my parents did a really good job of drilling into me that it was sort of a responsibility for me that I was going to have to always have.
Right.
And you know, there I don't really recall any moments during my childhood when I pushed back against my parents for doing my treatments. It was just such a mm-hmm. normal part of the day that, you know, it wasn't really something different for me. My parents did a really good job of making my treatment sessions very social. They did a good job of making my treatment sessions seem like they were normal, and there were times for when they would hang out with me, when my sister would hang out with me, when my friends would hang out with me. Everyone was always involved in my treatments and care from an early age.
Yeah, I noticed that shift too. I think that my parents noticed that I was realizing that. They made sure that it was more integrated into, you know, just the daily life and flow of things. And like, yep, this was the reality, and we're all gonna do this together, kind of thing. I also remember, so I had two hospitalizations within the same year, and the second one was...
Was this when you were six?
Yeah. The second one was a week before what was supposed to be my first big sleepover party at my friend Maggie's. And it was her birthday. And, like, that was the time of, like, best friends. And
as if you don't have best friends right now?
Yeah. Well, no, I do. But, like, that mattered. Like, the label best friend really mattered, you know? And I went to the hospital and they told me that we would have to go home, pack a bag, and come back. So on the way home to pack our bags, I can remember the tantrum that I threw in the backseat of my mom's minivan. And, I'll never forget this too, because in mid tantrum of like just screaming and crying, and my poor mom, because there's nothing she could have done to console her child who was missing her best friend's sleepover party because she had to be hospitalized. This truck next to us asks us to roll down our window and tells us that we have a flat tire.
Oh, God.
Oh, it was one of those days. Oh. And we had to wait, and we had to wait for AAA to come. And by the time AAA came, I could no longer go home and pack my own bag. And my mom had to drop me off at the hospital and then have my dad bring a bag. It was just a mess of a day. When it rains, it pours. But like that second hospitalization too was when I started to really see it as this like turning point in my like view of CF and how I would deal with it. Ironically, it's also when I, for a split second in my life, started journaling. And I like still have the journal that I was writing back then. It was actually a book that I was writing for CF patients and their parents. I wrote a poem. Oh, I should find this and read it. I'm sure it's priceless and not good at all, but
yeah, no, I would definitely love to hear that. That's a moment that stands out. How long were those hospital stays for?
2 weeks. And this was right before PICC lines were really introduced for that long of a stay. And I remember the one time my IVs kept blowing.
Oh, and like, worse.
Oh, my arm was like huge and red, and oh, it was so bad. It was so bad.
So for those of you who don't know what happens when an IV blows, basically just it stops working. That's essentially what it means.
Yeah, the veins no good, and they can't get the medicine in there anymore. So they were, so you know, I don't
sticking you and all that stuff.
Yeah, in the middle of the night, and you know, just things weren't going as planned. So I just remember, actually, those are really the only memories I have of those years. So it is interesting to me that that's kind of what. What also helped me, it was also like the beginning of me coping with having CF. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a negative. It didn't actually prompt me to then like deny like my care or anything. It just was, okay, this is the hand I was dealt. And now little 6-year-old me said that.
Yeah. But just taking over the whole thing.
Yeah.
Stubborn Julia.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I can totally recognize that as probably an appropriate response to the way things were going. I also, you know, I look back to when I was six, and obviously the fear that just overcame my body when I ran away from the operating room. I mean, that's like, I think that's something that really is probably pretty apparent in most people with CF, and it's also something that, you know, it's not talked about enough. But for me personally, my parents made a decision early on that they would learn how to do home IVs. They would teach me how to do it along the way. So I went from the age of 2 when I was first diagnosed all the way to when I was 19 without ever being hospitalized. So the first time I was hospitalized, I was well into college. I was a sophomore in college. And that was quite a shock for me because, A, I had to go home from Boston. I had to go back to New York to be hospitalized at Columbia Presbyterian and basically deal with what it was. And for me, what happened to me when I was hospitalized, I was actually, I was home on home IVs. There's the way that we would work it when I was a freshman sophomore in college, that if I did have to go home on IVs, I would go home, start the IV course for a few days, and then go back to Boston and basically do home IVs or home care from school. That was the way it worked. or at least that was the plan. And about a week, about 4 or 5 days into the course of IVs, I all of a sudden had really horrible, horrible abdominal pains. And it turned out that I had pancreatitis, so I had to be admitted into the hospital for pancreatitis, and which was, honestly, there's very few things in this world that I can imagine to be worse than pancreatitis. It's probably the most painful thing that I'll ever have to deal with. And the way that we basically had to treat it was I had to starve myself for a few days. And I couldn't drink, I couldn't eat until I figured out what was wrong. And then once I did figure out what was wrong, the way you gotta basically treat it is by just letting the pancreas heal over a few days. You know, I'm not a scientist or a doctor, so I can't tell you exactly what pancreatitis is other than that it's excruciating pain.
Yeah.
So there I was in the hospital, basically just losing all this weight and losing all this time away that I thought from college. And I knew that I was, let's put it this way, I knew that I was going to be fine and come out on the other end and like things were going to work themselves out. I never once felt like I was in jeopardy of anything. I actually refused pain medication. I wanted to basically have my senses about me so that I could make all the right decisions. Because I was one of those people that as soon as I turned 18, I was like, I want to be the person that makes every single decision about my body. I don't want to have other people making decisions for me. Obviously, I would be getting influence from my parents or, you know, the doctors, things like that. But ultimately, I want to be the person that
made those calls.
That made those calls in the moment.
Yeah.
Which is, it's probably a good thing and a bad thing. Because there were certain times when they were trying to figure out what pancreatitis was. And they basically tried to force feed me this liquid dye so I could get a CAT scan of my intestines or whatever.
Right.
And I would not do it. I refused to do it. I basically said, you haven't let me eat anything in 3-4 days. The first thing you're trying to put in my body is this liquid dye. Like, you have to be, for lack of a better word, you have to be blanking kidding me.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So, you have to, like, I was not about to let that happen. Which made the whole thing probably more difficult, more stressful for everyone involved. But ultimately, I don't regret doing that because it tastes so horrible and they were able to diagnose it anyways.
Yeah, but you know your own body. I mean, and...
Yeah, so, I definitely think that there was a... It was... Let's put it this way. It was very stressful. And
yeah.
I was probably dealing with more pain than my body had tolerance for. I found my pain threshold to be much higher than I really had anticipated. Because I refused to take the pain medication. Which, looking back, is probably one of the stupider things I probably could have done. But that was the way it worked. And ultimately, the pancreatitis is what led to me getting a feeding tube a few months down the road. So that was really the beginning part of my sophomore year. Then, in the late winter of my sophomore year, I was hospitalized again, but this time in Boston. Because I had some nasty, horrible, horrible virus. I was throwing up. I had a fever of like 105. I was coughing up, like, just horrible. Like, I mean... It's nauseating me right now to even think about how sick I was. So this is the second time that I was now hospitalized in 6 months and the second time that I've been hospitalized in 17 years. Well, the third time that I've been hospitalized in 17 years. And it was another horrifying, terrifying moment. But at the same time, like I recognized that I was just so sick in the moment that there's really hardly anything else you can do to like even... think about anything else. It's impossible to think about what your friends are doing in college, and that hospitalization actually led to me missing a school-wide ski trip to Mont Tremblant in Montreal. It was like basically a huge thing that most of the students at Boston College did every January, February. I forget exactly what it was called. It was called Snow Jam. My friends are gonna love me for dropping that, but I had to miss the trip because I was just so sick and I was unable to make it on the trip. One of my sister's friends got the same virus that I had, but she was in Montreal when it set on to her, and I like can hardly imagine what would have happened to me had I been on that trip and the virus showed itself a few days later. Like, oh, I mean,
yeah,
they don't speak English there, they do, but not really well, and it just would have been a horrible, horrible.
You would have been forced to use your French.
Oh yes, my
your my advanced French. Knowledge of French.
As far as my French goes, it's enough to pick up a girl in like a coffee shop. That's as far as I can talk to a girl in a coffee shop. That's as far as my French goes. Yeah, I have no medical French knowledge whatsoever. Yeah. Those are the two times that I was really hospitalized in my life, and they were both times when they were they were actually significant emergencies where I had to go to the emergency room and then be transferred to inpatient.
Yeah.
And they were just horrifying moments. And but ultimately, like I said, I was so sick that it didn't really matter. You know, it didn't really matter what else was going on because all I wanted to do was get better and get back to where I was. And yeah. I actually remember that the second time I was hospitalized, the day before all my friends went off to Canada for the snow jam trip, there was this fad that was going on that time in college. And I'm not sure if you remember it, but it had to do with when it was called icing somebody. You hide a Smirnoff ice, and then the kid would chug the Smirnoff ice because it's just the horrible, sugary, gross, girly drink. And it was just the funny thing to do to people. So my friends, my mom was now in Boston at this point. She was with me in the hospital. She basically drove through a snowstorm to get to me. But my friends, they were going to come down from Boston College to Boston Children's Hospital, which is like 15-minute cab ride or 15-minute ride on the T, as we called it, the mass transportation system. And they basically saw the doctor or resident fellow, basically the guy who had just graduated medical school, and they convinced him to bring in with my medications an ice, a Smirnoff ice. And the whole thing just went on. And my mom, like, it was just like, it was like a much needed sense of comic relief in such a very horrible, like, serious situation. Like, I was very sick. And they all, like, were masked up and gowned up, the whole thing. And then here comes the Smirnoff ice. And they're like, oh, we iced you, bro. Like, I can tell you, right? If I would have drank that thing, I probably would have just flatlined and, like, call it a day. Like, that probably would have been the end of it. But the joke ended there, and those are my two real emergency hospitalizations that I've ever had. Knock on wood, that's how it stays for a while.
I actually have two emergency hospitalizations around the same age. I guess the first one wasn't an emergency until we found out that I was quite sick, and then it was an emergency. I had moved to LA. I graduated high school a year early, moved to LA to record music with some producers, and it was my first trip back home to Philadelphia. And I was not feeling well at all. And I kept asking my mom, like, I think I'm going to end up staying at the hospital when we go there to get this checkup. And lo and behold, I was right. And that hospitalization was when we found out I had MRSA in my lungs, which was not fun and very scary. Luckily, we eradicated it over the 2-week stay that I was there. And then I went back out to LA and I was recording music, and I got a virus, what seemed like a virus. And for like 5 days, I had mild fever, and I woke up super early one morning, and like tears were streaming down my face, and I felt a pain in my side. And I was like, I must have slept really weirdly.
That's not right.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? My mom had been there with me through the fever, and I was like, I'm not going to wake her up about this like weird side pain just yet. But like while the tears were streaming down my face, I'm like, perhaps this is greater pain than I'm realizing. So I woke her up, and we called my doctor back home, and he was like, try putting the vest on. So I put the vest on, and I've never screamed like in the amount of pain that I had felt just by even the initial inflation of the vest and like the little hug it gives you.
Yeah.
And so we immediately rushed to the emergency room of Children's LA, and actually that was a time where I spoke up about my own care, like you did about the dye. The emergency room doctor wanted to give me a spinal tap.
Oh God!
And because he thought I had meningitis, and here I am actually at this point shaking, like my body was just shaking uncontrollably from the pain in my side, and I said to him, I have cystic fibrosis, and that's a lung disease. Might we take a lung X-ray
before we do anything else?
before you start
cutting off arms and legs. Yeah.
Yeah. Spinal tap. So he reluctantly agreed, and as soon as they did the lung X-ray, I had a partial lung collapse, and they got me some morphine, and that was the first time I was on any kind of pain medication, but in dire need of it as well. And I think psychologically for me, that stay and those Tuesdays, because they were so close together and right in the midst of me recording new music, I was very resentful at CF. I mean, like, there was nothing, no one to be mad at, but I started to really get frustrated and kind of, why me? Like, why now? Like, this seems to be the worst timing ever. but that also kind of catapulted me into starting my own nonprofit for CF. And, so I think I found ways to cope eventually through my nonprofit, and starting to speak out more. But initially, I actually moved back home for a while because I was just so emotionally torn up that I would have these two epic, that's terrible, but epic hospitalizations in the middle of me recording and pursuing my biggest dream. So I think that for me psychologically was probably the hardest time, other than being hospitalized mid first semester of college. That was pretty rough too.
I look back on some of those hospitalizations and I hear you tell that story. And, you know, I think about other moments that I've had where I've been exposed, not necessarily exposed, but I've had experience with a doctor who is not versed in cystic fibrosis. And it's a very weird feeling talking to a doctor and almost feeling like you know more about what's going on than that person does. And in all fairness, it's because the emergency room doctor, a lot of times, you know, probably learned about cystic fibrosis in, you know, maybe year one or year two of medical school and decided that he or she didn't want to go into pulmonology. So it's very important for you or the person that you're going to the emergency room with to understand the situation and recognize that you have to come across with the fact that you do have cystic fibrosis and that you don't have something else. I look at a time when I was younger and my family used to take a ski trip out west every year with other family friends. Then we were in Jackson Hole one year, and I was on the top of the mountain, and I had all things considered, it was a very relatively minor issue. I basically busted a capillary from skiing. I thought I was, you know, Bodie Miller doing the going down the green slopes, you know, and I busted a capillary, which is a very normal thing. And you bust a capillary, you cough up a little blood, and as we all know, a drop of blood makes a big pool in water. So that's why when you cough up blood, it looks like there's more of it than there actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone that was with me looked like they had just seen a ghost. Like, oh my God, Gunner's going to die up here on the mountain with us. And I'm like, no, guys, I'm fine. Like, if you call the ski patrol, I will push you down this mountain. So if I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out on my own terms. The funny is I can now look back on the story and laugh at it because of just how ridiculous it was. Because I got down to the mountain, I called my mom, I got my mom. You know, it's one of those things where, like, at that time and age, everyone, like, had the walkie-talkie, and they called each other on the mountain, like, Mom, it's Gunner, I'm at the bottom of the mountain, I'm having an issue, can you come find me, or something like that. And she took me to, like, the emergency clinic on the mountain in Jackson Hole. And I can promise you that this person working in the emergency clinic on Jackson is basically an orthopedic person. Like, he probably sees horrible, like, bone breaks or, you know, torn ACLs or blown out knees, blown out shoulders, concussions. He probably sees everything in the world except somebody with cystic fibrosis. So we call my doctor back home. We tell her what's happening, and she is reassuring us over the phone that most likely it's not something major. It's probably just a busted capillary or a whatever the term is for it, and basically convinces the emergency room person not to airlift us to Casper, Wyoming, where there's the biggest hospital. Rather, we need to just get a chest x-ray and somehow email it to the doctor, which in those days, it felt like we were working the dark ages where the whole email thing was sort of blossoming. Al Gore hadn't really done his thing yet, and we were still trying to – we had to basically get the chest x-ray footage from Wyoming to New York City over – President's Weekend. Okay, so that was the objective here. And there we are. I get the chest x-ray. The guy does the whole thing. And my mom and I are now in the waiting room, assuming that what's going to happen is this gentleman is going to send the to my doctor the results of the chest X-ray. He comes running out sweating in a mask, gloved up, gowned up, and he is convinced that I have tuberculosis. He has now convinced himself after looking at one X-ray and the fact that I have coughed up a little blood that I have tuberculosis.
Oh, no.
He has been exposed to it in Jackson Hole.
Oh, you have to laugh when you you have to laugh.
My mom and I just start laughing immediately. Just immediately start laughing. And this guy is like, he's like, I'm calling in the airlift. Like, we're sending you out of here. You got to get out of here. Everyone here is exposed, the whole thing. And we're like, no. That's not what's going on here. He doesn't have tuberculosis. Can we call the doctor? And the doctor will then describe to you what a typical chest X-ray of a cystic fibrosis person looks like, what a typical X-ray of Gunnar Esiason looks like, and then you'll explain the X-ray to her, and she will diagnose it. Because there, for some reason, this guy was incapable of sending the X-ray via email to my doctor. We get the doctor on the phone. They have a conversation, and she has now convinced this man that I have cystic fibrosis and that you do not have tuberculosis. And they have come to a conclusion that the X-ray is perfectly normal and that I had a busted capillary. And then I should just go home and stop skiing for the rest of the weekend and relax.
It's important to make sure they know you know.
Exactly. Yeah. It was one of those situations where this guy is like, I'm sure this guy probably sees 10 broken legs in a day.
Yeah.
People skiing and being idiots and falling off chairlifts and all that stuff. And
totally.
Actually, I had a friend who fell off a chairlift once. It's hilarious. But,
yes, sounds so much, so funny. Sounds awful.
It probably is horrible. I can laugh because it wasn't me. That was my story about experiencing a doctor who had no experience with cystic fibrosis.
Yeah. It's important to be your own advocate in that moment.
Exactly. Gunnar, you have tuberculosis. No, doctor, I don't. I don't have tuberculosis.
Sorry. Yeah, and in their defense, they are taught to diagnose quickly, so they only jump to those conclusions because they're like, oh shoot, I have to tell him what he has, and this is the only thing that I know.
I mean, I hear that because I was such a young person at that age. If I was there with maybe just some family friends or someone, and rather than my mom or my dad, I would have in fact been airlifted to Casper, which is a city in Wyoming, apparently.
Yeah, that would not have been fun.
Can you name 5 cities in Wyoming?
No.
I can name Laramie, Jackson, Casper.
Yeah.
That's all I have for you.
Crickets.
The good people in Wyoming.
I'm Bo Benz.
Honestly, Wyoming is a great place. Everyone's like a cowboy out there still. It's so cool. You go out there.
I'm sure it's beautiful.
It's like a different world. But unfortunately, the elevation is like 10,000 feet wherever you go, and you're like, hey there. You feel like Darth Vader walking around. Just saw Star Wars last week. It was awesome. Loved it. It's better than Force Awakens. Rogue One. I'm actually going to go see it again this week. I want to see it this time in IMAX because my friends made me see it not in IMAX, and I'm pretty salty about that. Because when I watch space movies, I want to feel like I'm in space. You know what I'm saying? Like, I want to feel like I'm Neil Armstrong.
Yeah.
Fighting to save the galaxy, or Obi-Wan using the Force on some evil Empire stormtroopers. But anyways, let's get back to our topic here. Obviously, this is a major topic. We'll get back to it in another podcast for sure, because we have to talk about maintenance days, which we really haven't done. We didn't really get a chance to talk about that day. And maintenance days, what I mean by that, are planned hospital stays where you go in just for treatment rather than being rushed to the emergency room for pancreatitis or the flu or, in Julia's case, a collapsed lung or, in my case, a false tuberculosis diagnosis.
Yeah, I think it's super important to acknowledge the psychosocial effects of these hospital stays on CF patients. And I think it's important as patients and families to support and speak about it more openly, because I think it is a very real aspect of CF care is emotional and mental well-being, and perhaps we're only just on the cusp of really learning how to talk openly about it and understand the kind of the depth that can have. So
yeah, for sure. And I do think that there are ways to support people with cystic fibrosis who are in the hospital. Yep. Like my friends obviously chose to try and ice me because we were in college and that's what college kids did. And it made me laugh. But there are other ways. And I know, Julie, you have a few ways to share.
Yeah, I actually get asked a lot, and my mom gets asked a lot, like, what can people give when I'm in the hospital or what can they bring to help this day? And my mom and I have both received this from respective friends of ours, but pre-stamped and return address labeled envelopes and thank you cards for any gifts, so that you can just also not even just thank you notes. Just it's a nice time just to write notes to people that are in your life and that end up coming to visit you or send you something. Kind of takes the stress of getting them in the mail off the patient and their family's back. So I think that's a really great thing to give people. I also think food that can be shared. Like my brother once bought this box of soft pretzels, which is one of my favorite things in the world, to me in the hospital so that I could give them to my nurses and my doctors and share them with the other patients on the floor. Obviously, I didn't leave my room, but the pretzels did. So I think food that you can share. And then I also think it's really important, especially for younger families. I'm seeing a lot on my Facebook newsfeed, unfortunately, the families that are dealing with CF hospitalizations during the holiday season. And they have siblings that don't have CF. And something that was really nice for my family was the families that surrounded us that remembered the siblings that weren't, like my brothers, when they weren't in the hospital. Because I think it's hard for a family to balance the attention. And then if another family is thinking about that too, I think that's really important. Yeah, so
those are really great ideas. And I look back when I'm sick and I've recognized that there's obviously been things that people have gotten me other than Smirnoff ice when I'm in the hospital. And the one thing that I always look back was it actually came from another person with CF. A family friend of mine that I've known for quite a while. And she sent me like a giant warm blanket because when you're sick and you're feverish and you have the chills and all this stuff, there's nothing that you rather want than to be warm. So one day in the mail, I was home on IVs and I opened up a package and it was just a giant warm blanket. Unfortunately, my dog has sort of usurped the blanket from me at this point. But
that's when you know it's comfortable though.
Yes, exactly. In the moment, it was a great gift, and it's definitely something I think that are that people in the hospital appreciate.
Oh, totally. Well, speaking of warm and comfortable blankets in the hospital, our Making It Matter is Morgan Yoni. She is a young girl she was waiting for a double lung transplant, her second double lung transplant, but got the call just last week. But before she got the call, she was asked by someone what her Christmas wish was. And she said she would love to collect 160 blankets for those in the hospital and in her hospital. And the community responded in a much bigger way. And they've collected over 1,500 blankets. And they are now distributing them to all of the surrounding hospitals in the Pittsburgh area. And it's all because of Morgan's selfless wish, really. Here she is waiting for her second double lung transplant, and she was looking to make the day of other patients a little more comfortable and warmer. So thanks, Morgan, for making it matter. You're in my thoughts and prayers, and as you recover, and you're a huge inspiration to me and just such a warrior. So thanks for making it matter.
Yeah, awesome job, Morgan. That story really doesn't need much more. Then you've already said that's just an unbelievable moment. I got the chills as you were talking about it. But that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in for the 19th episode of Making It Matter. Remember, you can follow along with our weekly podcast via my YouTube channel on GunnarSiason.com, on JuliaRay.com. You can also follow us on Instagram, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes. Also, make sure you give us a favorable review on iTunes. Because that definitely helps us climb the iTunes charts as one day we plan to take over the iTunes world and become the most popular podcast out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you want to see his podcast about something specific, you can always send us an email at gunnersblog@assiasin.org or send us a message on Facebook because we love talking to people.
Or Twitter.
Yes, or Twitter. As we've seen. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So Merry Christmas, everyone. Have a great holidays. Yes. And we'll be back next week.
Bye, everyone. Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah.